A nation newly at war, and a coast on edge.
Remembering the Battle of Los Angeles, life in the old new normal.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our west coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hi, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And welcome back to the Angry History Show.
We're going to spend this show talking about the air raid scare that terrified the city of Los Angeles in February 1942, and the annual commemoration of the event that's held at Fort MacArthur in the San Pedro section of town.
Yep, nothing quite like this had ever happened in the States before, and the impact still resonates 73 years later with the country at war again.
The Second World War was what TR might call our country's crowded hour, and had no shortage of moments that would become part of our national tapestry.
Yeah, that's right. And the so-called Battle of Los Angeles was a bracing event. It was a night of terror and upset for a city that felt very much in the gaze of Imperial Japan. And the annual remembrance at Fort MacArthur provides us a window not just into the mechanics of that morning, but gives those who choose to remember an evocation of what American life was like on the newly minted home front. Want to immediately go right to the guy who made all this possible. His name is Steve Nelson. He runs a show over at Fort MacArthur. Here's Steve.
I'm Steve Nelson, and I'm the curator and the director of the Fort MacArthur Museum down in San Pedro. Basically, what I do is I'm a historic resource manager, and I take care of the various military historic resources that are left on the property.
What do you have left on the property?
Well, we have several World War I era gun batteries, a few World War II barracks. We have some barracks that were built as part of FDR's original stimulus, you know, from the Depression, those kinds of things. And then we have some modern things like the Korean Friendship Bell and some park areas and things of that nature. And while I don't necessarily oversee all of it, the historic elements of it are something that I take care of.
And from what you tell me, Steve and the fine folks at Fort MacArthur were not stingy with the bang bang. Check.
That's a 50 cal. It's a 50 caliber gun firing off into the sky. And there's some fireworks thrown in there, a lot of small arms fire. It was pretty insane to be there. You'll hear more of it later in the show, but it was, you know, to be right in the middle of it was quite something.
Must have been something just to be near those guns. And then you think of these men who sat by them 24-7 shooting them off. They hadn't been in war before, and there they are firing. It's because they're told, hey, keep firing. Whatever's out there, shoot. There's something
right
out there.
Exactly. The Southland was a mass of jitters, as you might imagine. You know, we were at war, and in the early morning of February 25th, 1942, the anti-aircraft guns charged with protecting L.A. belched more than 1,500 shells out into the darkness. No enemy returned fire. People were panicked. Not surprisingly, the city had a lot of reasons to be on edge. So why so jittery?
Well, Operation Drumbeat, for one thing, not to mention Pearl Harbor, of course, but Operation Drumbeat was the sinking of ship after ship on the East Coast, and people would have been very aware of that. The Japanese were on the march in the Pacific, and the Germans, of course, we'd been watching gobble up countries in Europe for a few years now, so this is why people were saying, wow, it's coming here.
Absolutely. You know, the Imperial Japanese at this point, too, seemed unstoppable initially. You know, on December 8th, the rising sun had destroyed most of the U.S. Army Air Corps in the Philippines. And in the coming weeks, they attacked not only the Philippines, but Hong Kong, Wake Island, Guam, New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, Bali, Timor, Singapore, Dutch East Indies, and Burma.
These were all areas that, well, some are U.S. territories, but these are all friendly right. nations that are being attacked, being driven out. And part of the thing with Japan was they were rolling and they had beaten Russia. Now, that's 40 years before. So, okay, when we were kids, that's something you would think of. And they'd beaten a European power and they were still a mysterious country. And I think this is much like what we talked about in the Okide episode, where the that's Axis right. is sweeping away everybody that they come in contact with, everybody they invade, and at some point somebody needs to stop them, but it hasn't happened so far. So this is scary. You don't feel prepared, and no kidding, there were jitters.
No, and you add to that this notion of rumors, you know, and rumors can do so much damage. On February 13th, for example, there was a report to headquarters, 39th Brigade, Seattle, stated that a strong rumor in the Japanese-American neighborhoods predicted the West Coast would be bombed on February 18th. That day passed peacefully, as had the days before. It reminds me, Dean, of the early times post 9/11, you know, where everything is going to be attacked next week. You know, we're getting all this intel. Or, oh, gosh, did you hear the city ordered 300,000 body bags? You know, this kind of stuff, you know, wears on the mind. Terror works.
Yeah, that definitely rumor will travel faster than fact, as we see. And these were all people who knew that fifth columns were part of the fascist ideology.
Oh,
Nazis,
yeah.
We've seen the video of them being welcomed into Austria. We've seen what happened in France. They set up half the country there as a puppet state. So it yep. was a strategy. And not that people were thinking factually in a moment like this, which is part of the problem.
No.
But
that's right.
it certainly was a real thing. And it's an infamia that you have innocent people get caught up and be the victims. That's part of war. And it's terrible that this was on our coast. This wasn't the lady who was eventually convicted of being Tokyo Rose, who wasn't. What happened
right.
to her in Japan, she got stranded there as an American and stuck,
yeah.
not able to work. She was working very hard for POWs. You get doubly victimized, whichever side you're on.
Absolutely. And this is what we're sort of getting at here is Executive Order 9066, which FDR signed on February 19th, 1942, just a few days before this scare. And the order called for tens of thousands of Japanese American citizens to be rounded up and put in camps, you know, so as not to harm their fellow Americans, potentially. And we're going to do more on that later, along with a quick conversation with a man I met that night at Fort MacArthur who lived through that insanity.
I was reading that executive order of Franklin Roosevelt's. And it's interesting that we always think of that stating, okay, start rounding people up.
Right.
The insidious thing about it and disturbing for democracy is it doesn't say that in so many words. He turns a lot of power over whatever the military commanders deem should be necessary, do all things mm-hmm. possible, never mentions the word Japanese Americans, never mentions the word even right. enemy nationals, doesn't, just puts it in their hand. And that's something that bothers me just about the way that they did it that we'll, again, get to a little bit later. This is whetting the appetite.
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, Washington's birthday is a most appropriate occasion for us to talk with each other about things as they are today and things as we know they shall be in the future.
As FDR addressed the nation during his February 23rd fireside chat, the Japanese did launch a small attack. A large Japanese sub named I-17 surfaces near oil facilities off the coast of Goleta near Santa Barbara at sundown. It fired its deck gun for about 20 minutes and did only about $500 in damage. The sub had been spotted in Santa Barbara Channel about an hour before the attacks.
And that's so weird, just sitting there in the channel. This was said to be the first attack on the U.S. mainland by a hostile nation since the sack of Washington, D.C. in the War of 1812. You can go listen to that show 2 weeks ago. According to Kenneth Howe, a Ph.D. candidate in UC Santa Barbara's History Department, an 1846 border dust-up during the Mexican-American War and a 1918 sub-attack on a Cape Cod barge during the Great War predate the Goleta shelling. And of course, you know, years later, all these would be dwarfed by 9/11.
And we might count the Black Tom attack, too, which was a Great War attack on the munitions factory there. We've talked about before in Jersey City, right behind
Jersey.
The Statue
mm-hmm.
of Liberty. And they snuck in there. Again, we were just talking about fifth columns. This was a real fear. This had happened. This huge explosion, this huge act of sabotage. So people were not paranoid in a way we might think today. If you said the Japanese were going to attack, of course, you'd think that was paranoia. But at the time, there was a war going on. It's hard to put our minds in that. It's easy, I I think, to say, well, these people were just crazy and they were shooting at nothing. And it was a real world war out there going on, and they had reason to be afraid.
Absolutely. And you add to this tension with this Goleta shelling, you know, of course, immediately people start to say, you know, there were signal lights in the Goleta foothills before and after the attack, which, of course, would have implicated folks on the shore, probably Americans. While others claimed the whole thing was a government hoax to push war bond sales, which is kind of crazy. But
everyone has their ideas. I guess if they had Twitter in the day, it would be very interesting to go look at the feed. I don't know how they'll log all that, but everybody decides they're going to be smart. And
it'll be on Vmail. It'll take you forever to get your tweet. You
know? Yeah, so I think that's one of the things here, is that people always are going to wonder what it was. There's so much misinformation. And you can look at something after. There's collective memory. There's collective hallucinations, and not know really what's going on. Japanese, this is a warrior culture, too. We mentioned before, it's still kind of mystery. It's not like Italians and Germans who'd been here for generations. And, oh, you'd think of Enzo the Baker, or you would think of your...
for your father,
your German father. No, they have Oktoberfest. It's that great old film after the war where they say, we've forgiven these people twice or before. Let's not do it a third time. There was the war in 1871 where they invade France. There's World War II. Now there's been World War III. We're going to do it again. And so that's part of it. And I guess in today's terms, you'd say they had a better brand, the Germans and Italians, than the Japanese. They didn't have somebody who had just ran for president like Wendell Willkie in 1940 that could stand up and say, oh, that's what I think of as a German. Or Babe Ruth in that episode. We played the clip of him coming out and denouncing Nazism as a German-American. The Japanese didn't have those high-profile people to step up and say, hey, when you think of a Japanese person, think of me. Don't think of Hirohito. Don't think of Tojo. Don't think of Yamamoto. Think of me. And so that was really hard to deal with, as we'll hear.
We're gonna have to slap the dirty little Jap, and Uncle Sam's the guy who can do it.
The country was infuriated by the imperial Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, and media, you know, as it does, helped stoke fear and anger through popular music like this Carson Robeson song and editorials like this from CBS's Earl Godwin on February 21st. Give a listen.
I take a chance on thus preaching rather than reporting today because spot news in Washington is not so hot. The Army, of course, is glad to have the President's order permitting the delineation of Jap-out areas on the West Coast. But Attorney General Biddle here cautions one and all that this is not martial law, such as you heard about from Jim Wall, was it, in Honolulu, wherein the right of habeas corpus is suspended and civil rights go glimmering. Of course, this is not an invitation to Japs and Nazis to try to beat the Army's evacuation orders with the courts. However, when the Dyes Committee yellow paper comes out next week, I think the public will get a glimpse in long detail of some of the Jap activities in spy work along the West Coast.
There he was, just dangling intel he didn't necessarily have in front of an anxious audience, you know? There were a lot of ingredients that went into this explosive stew.
The L.A. of the Second World War was a serious boomtown. The entire L.A. metropolitan area grew faster than any other metropolitan area in the country. An incredible amount of wartime production was staged there, and by 1943, the population of Metro L.A. was greater than that of 37 states.
And by war's end, L.A. had produced 17% of the entire nation's war turnout. In February 42, its ethnic Japanese, for whom life was about to start really sucking, numbered nearly 80,000 in the city.
Despite the fear, anger, and uncertainty, media pumped out dependable distractions like the number one single the week of February 21st, Glenn Miller's A String of Pearls.
Yeah, I love this song. It's so funny. It's like, oh, wait, this is an old song? Yeah, I guess it is.
Yeah. No. I guess we could have said Captain Glenn Miller. He was out over there serving. Another change here that people were of all walks of life were in the war effort one way or the other.
That's the truth.
Or he lost his life in a plane over there.
Yep. And of course, you know, you had plenty of radio shows and dramas, and as always. And there, of course, was the greatest escape of them all, the movies. And the big one out that week in February was the musical Born to Sing.
Want to be in a show?
Yes!
I want you to line up every one of my cabs in front of Cartwright's Theater, and then when that audience comes busting out, load them in. And no matter what address they give you, bring them straight to the kids' show, and I'll be there on the reception committee.
That everybody in the show pitched in. All these swell boys and girls, Pete, Detroit, and everybody. Why, even the neighbors in the block. Because they wanted Dad's songs heard. They believed it right. I know y'all believe in fair play, too. I just know it.
The tough guy voice in the trailer. That has to be Sheldon Leonard, no?
C.C. Batman. I was researching this the other night, and my ears pricked up when I heard him. I love that guy.
Yeah, most of us likely remember him as Nick the Bartender in It's a Wonderful Life and Martini's Place walking right. In there. Of course, there's a dank dive bar you'd love to visit in Hollywood.
You could drink the heart out of a perfectly good evening in that place.
That's for sure. And you know the cab drivers, Bert and Ernie, to take you home.
That's
perfect.
Right.
I even know a cabbie in that place to get me.
Exactly.
Yeah, gosh, let's go.
In the pre-Uber years, you know.
Yeah. But here's alt-universe evil Nick, who I like to picture with a goatee on the spot. Just about done getting his stones broken by the annoying, unintentionally, Henry Travers, Clarence the Angel.
Hey, look, mister. We save hard drinks in here for men who want to get drunk fast, and we don't need any characters around to give the joint atmosphere. Is that clear? Do I have to slip you my lip for a convincer?
What's he talking about?
Oh, Nick. Just give him the same as mine. He's okay.
Okay.
Nick's place is not a hipster bar, Clarence. Now go home and get your shine box. Sheldon Leonard actually ended up having more success behind the camera as a TV producer and director, which is very cool.
He partnered up with the legendary Danny Thomas and, among other gigs, was executive producer of The Danny Thomas Show, The Dick Van Dyke Show, The Andy Griffith Show, and The Bill Dana Show.
Yeah, they had really creative titles back then in the age of television. So great discovering these little nuggets. Yeah. Leonard died in 1997, by the way, at 89. What were you going to say?
I was going to say that's one thing they talked to Bob Newhart. And when he had his fourth show, he said, well, I had the Bob Newhart show. Then it was the right. Newhart show. Then it was just Newhart. He said, if I have another show, it's just going to be called The.
The, yeah, or just put an umlaut over something and you'll be done with it. I think we're doing a show about the Battle of Los Angeles, apparently.
That's right, we are.
That happens. You know. So Fort MacArthur had its annual air raid event in San Pedro, and I went over there. I had to check this out. You know, the scare has been sort of rattling around in my wheelhouse for a very, very long time, as you know. We did that show a couple weeks ago on the first air raid drill, and that was sort of in preparation for this McGill. I hope you guys have some time today. Think about it. When you walk into this place, it really feels like you've stepped through the Guardian of forever. You know, it's full committal with the costumes and the vehicles and just tons of little detailed touches that just sell the whole thing. Pretty exciting.
And the music, too, that we're going to hear. Glenn Miller, obviously, that always takes you right back. You said the other day you listen to Glenn Miller as if it's for the first time. For me, All those songs, playing him a million times in the band, high school, college, and he's from the town next to where I grew up. His house is there. So I always felt a special connection to him. I like that he's just listed there with the War Dead, just like anybody else, on the plaque, instead of some big thing for him.
That's
it wasn't about
him.
It was about serving.
No, it was about serving and trying to bring the folks a little taste of home, you know, when they're in the horror of war. I always think of him, too, you know, knowing him so well and his music so well. And I think of my mom and my aunts, you know, dancing at family parties to In the Mood and all that. And, yeah, he was always part of our lives. But picture, here I am. I'm walking around this place, and it's shocking because it's, you know, some people have their cosplay thing and you walk in, hey, Scarlet Witch, hey, you know, Spider-Man. This to me is like the ultimate cosplay. People just dress to the nines in their 40s finest. And anyway, so I'm walking in there. I'm there with Paul McNamee and my buddy Paul. Paul is a great friend and also a great producer, and he sort of accompanied me that day. And I'm keeping my eyes out for Steve Nelson as I'm walking around, and out of nowhere, like a blur, Steve finds me.
Hello,
Steve, how are you?
We need to we have a date at the TAM at some point.
Yes.
Come and see my wife.
And Steve Nelson, Paul McNamara.
Hey, Paul, Steve, how are you? Nice to meet you.
We just met your dad, but by happenstance as well. Steve, I'll tell you, I am having the time of my life today.
Are you?
I couldn't.
You hear those airplanes?
Yeah. We've got to hear all better.
Wait till you hear the 50 caliber.
I cannot wait. I'm just so glad to be here.
How are you?
Can't wait indeed for the 50 caliber to go off. It was insane, but we'll get to that again. But what you're sort of seeing when you're here is it's just a recreation of the time. And of course, you know, it's aspects of the best of that time. It's the romanticized, idealized version of that, which is absolutely fine. It puts you in a mind frame to think about these things. It's terrific. You know, they had the flag ceremony, and they had young guys in dress greens, you know, taking the flag and folding it. They had this really neat thing, a bit of veteran recognition. Here's MC Dean Moore.
My name is Dean Moore. This is the Fort MacArthur Officers Orchestra. We now like to clear the desk for a little bit. We'd like to do a special presentation. We're going to be playing the song for each branch of the military. And for those of you veterans who are represented by that song, please step to the middle of the dance floor so we can acknowledge your service. If you're a reenactor and you're stepping in there, we know who you are.
These guys are serious about reenacting and about doing it as honor, not doing it as any kind of parody, not doing it as, hey, let's just dress up in the uniform here of somebody.
Right.
They take it very seriously. We're going to talk about that in the D-Day episode. We know from Civil War reenactments, probably people are most familiar with.
Seven active war veterans, Navy personnel. Eight.
It's really about acting it out to honor those people, just like we do the Lincoln-Douglas debates or just like we do anything else. And that's a great thing. It's got to make you feel connected if you're a member of the service.
Right. And Steve has a good point about this idea of the reenacting for this particular event actually happening where everything went down. Give a listen to Steve Nelson.
What we're trying to do is encapsulate a period of time and then make it live again. And you can never do that effectively. We know that. But we certainly give you a glimpse into 1941, 1942. We give you an idea. The music that is being played is the music, you know, with some, you know, latitude of the period. The equipment that you see, we are working our best to make sure that the equipment that you see is actually from the period. Again, some things we bring out are from a later date, these kinds of things. But it still gives you that overall feel. And we just want to create an experience that you can't get anywhere else.
You've done that. And to have it, the location, I mean, it's such a dramatic location visually. And then it's so history packed. I mean, this is where it all went down, and that makes a huge difference.
I think that's the most important part, is the fact that we didn't just recreate something, some event in history. For example, you might find a reenactment battle of the Battle of the Bulge in, let's say, Big Bear. Which, you know, I understand what they're trying to achieve, but what we're doing actually happened there. We're trying to recreate that, if not the actual event, because, again, we can't do that. We want to give you the feeling, or at least the a tangible feeling of what it was like here in Los Angeles.
And for me, I absolutely felt as though I was transported to a degree. I mean, you allow yourself, you give yourself over to the experience as well, and that was so easy to me because everyone was so enthused. Everyone was looked great. So many people dressed. Why is it so important, this living history aspect of it? And how do you deal with the reenactors? Are there formal groups that come? Is it sort of, how does that, the reenactor aspect of this come into play?
Well, believe it or not, it's really by chance. A lot of it, we've become sort of a cult event amongst reenactors, and I think the thing I like about it most is how many people are smiling. The dancers who may not care about the military equipment are smiling. The military enthusiasts are smiling even though they may not care about the music. The musicians are smiling because people are enjoying it. And generally, believe it or not, we didn't have a negative complaint. And, you know, we've got over, I think, 1,200 people there. And, you know, it's cold, it's outdoor, there's uneven ground, it's loud, it's awkward, it's everything that an event venue should not be. And yet we pull off this really neat experience, and it's just wonderful.
And I think maybe why people are so engaged in it is because it's such a non-traditional place and event. I mean, it was, I keep saying it, I was just sort of floating a couple inches off the ground the whole time just because of the immersive nature of it.
Loving the music. You listen to that, you're hearing it, and you've got to be transported back. And I was thinking it's such a staple for musicians. I had a moment with it where I wanted that at my wedding for my wife and I to walk down when they first announced here. I said, I want In the Mood. Because as I said, this had played such a big part in my life, and you can't get anything more up than that. And we're both people that love the 40s and love the past and love history. So this is great. And one of my groomsmen, who I will leave nameless, but Owen knows him, he came up to me and he said, the band said they don't know how to play In the Mood. I'd gone and met the band, so I knew already. I knew these guys. They're professional Broadway musicians. They played with all kinds of different musicians. The one guy said to me, I'm going to slip my trombone in. I'm not being paid to bring my trombone. And the guy who was renting us the band, basically their manager, said, no, you can't do that. Don't do it. But he said, I'm going to slip it in there, so I will have that. It was a great, great band. And I looked at my groomsmen, and you panicked, right? You've just gotten married. You're going to go down. And I looked at him and I said, There's not a trombone player on the planet Earth since 1942 that doesn't know in the
movie. Doesn't know that, right.
And so he just busted up laughing. And, I said, yeah, you try to fool me with that one. You could have told me anything. Tell me the cake didn't come from the caterer. Tell me my wife ran off. I would have completely believed that.
Exactly.
But you can't tell me that they don't know In the Mood. That's what a soundtrack it is for really the United States of America in the war and post-war years.
That's true. And I'll tell you what, the band at Fort MacArthur, they knew In the Mood. They seemed to know everything, which is great. And it's just so easy, like I said, just to get yourself in that mindset when you have all these elements. And it was pretty cool. I was walking around at one point and see this little kid standing there, and you know, he's got his dress greens on. And I went over and I introduced myself, wanted to see what was on this boy's mind. Give a listen. So I'm standing here with a young man who is wearing his dress greens and drinking some sort of Monster energy drink, which I don't think was part of the ration rollout in the Second World War. What's your name, young man?
Ben.
Ben, what are you doing here?
Just enjoying sights and here for the air raid.
What do you like about being at this event? And do you understand the significance? Why do this as opposed to anything else you could do on a Saturday?
Well, I've been coming for 5 years. Ten. Ever since I was five, but. It's just really cool. It's really great. The trees, the music, everything, the dancing. Plus, I like Army, so.
Well, Ben, thank you very much, and enjoy yourself today.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
I actually ran into Ben later after the raid part, and he was just out there picking up empty shell casings, as you want to do when you're a boy. He loved
That's
it.
Great. It's funny, when I was listening to that and you talking to him, I thought, how great a young person is interested in our time. And then I thought, my gosh, these veterans and these people who are alive at the time, they look at us that way. I said, that's not our day. Until they start doing reenactments of the invasion of Grenada, this is not going to be a war
where
we were young and had that same connection. But it's funny to look at somebody that age as if we're remembering this ourselves, because you're just so into that moment. It's incredible.
Well, it is. And this is sort of the thing, you know, when your brain is willing, or at least if your brain is being led by your soul in a situation like this, it's so easy to sort of get in there and remain in this environment. I ran into a guy there a couple times, and he couldn't miss me. It's awesome. He's wearing a zoot suit, you know, which is awesome. It's a great looking suit. But he wore that for a reason, because he knew his history, and he was representing another historical angle of wartime Los Angeles, which was, you know, racial tension between segregated, largely white armed forces and the growing number of Latinos in LA. So, you know, it was cool. It's like everybody brought a little bit of what stands out in their memory or means something to them to this is what it really seemed like. The funny thing is, the idea, you know, generally is that you're at Fort MacArthur, 1942. That's the conceit of this day. But what happens is you end up getting some pretty amusing get-ups. Give a listen to Steve.
We got people in all kinds of stuff. Some stuff doesn't fit, but we've never thrown anybody out. You know, it's just, you know, if you're being disruptive, that's one thing. But, you know, I don't know if you noticed, there was a guy dressed as an Italian fascist from Mussolini's Black Shirt Brigade. I mean, you know, you just sit there, you scratch your head and you go, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you have a need to express this, but, you know, my vision is that it's Los Angeles, 1942. But that's my vision. And if these folks are paying to get in, you know, I mean, again, we don't want anything disruptive, but...
Right, that Black shirt would have been strung up by his feet if he was in that crowd.
Well, that, you know... all right, yes, you are right. And there were some under-the-cuff, you know, remarks about, let's go get that guy or something. But again, whatever the case is even everyone was having fun, so...
There was a fight that I saw break out. On the dance floor, between a sailor and a Marine, and it almost got pretty ugly out there. We got a Marine and a sailor facing off.
Flyboy, Junior Birdman.
Hey.
Hey, Junior Birdman.
Hey.
You can't do nothing.
Stay over there.
Can't do nothing, boy. What, dirt pan sailor from Oklahoma, you know nothing.
Hey! Hey!
Uh-oh, we got a fight breaking out on the dance floor here.
Get over here.
Well, it's war time. I loved that. It was so great because it was right in the middle of it, and then all of a sudden, you know, reenactors pick up their script and go to town.
That was added a couple of years ago, too, and we've done it a number of different ways. We had, we had some guy come in and was protesting the war or something like that, and so they arrested him. Then we had, delinquent guys. Sometimes there would be people dressed in military uniforms that their hair was too long, and so the shore patrol would go over and bust them for a while and then make... It was almost extortion. We would make them buy them out of jail,
right.
And the money, of course, went to the donation box, but, you know, whatever the case, it was still just kind of a fun evening.
Can you imagine somebody wearing a Mussolini shirt out in public?
No. No, I can't. Paul and I couldn't help but get caught up in the 40s action here. This is funny.
Just being here makes me want to talk like this. It's wartime. Paulie?
Aces, look at all these crazy dames.
Look at all these crazy dames. And all these young G.I. Joes ready to go off to a foreign land and fight this war.
You go your way, I'll go mine.
Buy bonds!
Yes, buy bonds. War bonds. Not ward bonds.
Chappie.
I like that fellow, the cut of his jib.
He's fantastic. He's a great guy. All around top fellow.
You were saying about going to one of these events, and if you do, I'm sure that there are ones in your area wherever you are within the sound of my voice. Although we haven't had a listener yet from Greenland. So if you know anybody in Greenland, recommend them the show.
Yeah,
because
hook them up.
There's World War II action there too, believe it or not. They have some great stories. But if you do go, give yourself over to it. And I think you did that this weekend, didn't you? You really did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I felt so out of place because I was wearing 2015 clothes. It sucked.
Yeah, because if you open that door, and as you said, if you lead with your soul, if you have the imagination, you can have some really surreal and wonderful experiences. And I'm thinking of one that I had, again, with my wife. We went to London, and we were at the Cabinet War Rooms, now the Churchill War Rooms.
You guys had a great trip. That was an awesome trip.
That was fantastic. Yeah. And to be in the spot where Churchill was, and he's leading the war from there, and you're seeing they have all their little rooms preserved. You can see a fair bit of it online, but of course that's not the same as actually being there.
Sure.
But you're in the bunker and you're walking around and it's dark and the war is all going around. They also had period music, a group like the Three Bells, although not them that we've heard, that
right.
did the Andrew Sisters type songs. And you're just walking around in the darkness there and you turn – and there's an RAF major standing right in front of you in the period dress. And for me, having seen all the statues dressed like that and all of this, it was really a surreal moment. It was as if he'd just come alive and he's there and he's going on shift during World War II, waiting out the Blitz, trying to save the world from the Nazi scourge.
Yeah.
And it was a real moment where the past and the present blurred for me personally. And I turned to my wife and said, "You saw him too, right?" Because it was really as if he'd stepped out of the past. Now, yep. I do have to add one caveat, of course.
Sure.
They were serving buckets of Sir Winston Churchill's favorite champagne, Paul Roger, which did kind of help open my consciousness to this moment of traveling
hey,
into the past.
That happens. You know, it's an intellectual lubricant. What can we say?
Let's shift back to 1942 now. And before we dive into the specifics of the scare, let's give a listen to how CBS's Byron Palmer reported it the morning of the 25th.
The News of the World, Wednesday, February 25th. Once again, Columbia's correspondents in world capitals and in the fighting zones in the Western Pacific are ready to give you the latest news direct by shortwave radio. And now for news of our own West Coast, we take you to Los Angeles and the report of Byron Palmer.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp. However, it required nearly 30 minutes to travel some 25 miles, far slower than an airplane. Watchers on the rooftop of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood could plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area. Concussion of the shells could be felt in downtown Los Angeles, 15 miles away. U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark skies, but whether they contacted the object has not been announced. Army officials say they will not comment until they receive a full report of the action. Although some watchers say they saw airplanes in the air, semi-official sources say they probably were the U.S. Army's pursuit. Several observers say they saw one or more planes spotlighted by 20 or 30 searchlights. The object moved southward, presumably over Huntington Park at the western edge of Los Angeles, and on southward to about Long Beach on the coast. By 3:30 a.m., observers said the object appeared to be over the south of Long Beach. Searchlights closely followed the object down the coast and kept it centered in their glare. Shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit it. The shooting stopped about 3:30 a.m. The shooting brought warfare to the front door of this city of 1.25 million population for the first time since December 7th. Already, it was alert to the presence off the Southern California coast of a Japanese submarine which had pumped 25 shells into an oil field north of Santa Barbara Monday evening. Because of the presence of the submarine, a three-hour alert was ordered at dusk last night, and civilian authorities stood at their posts while the Army and Navy continued their search for the submersible. The evening alert ended at 10:23 p.m., but another was sounded at 2:22 a.m., and the blackout followed within 3 minutes. It covered Los Angeles County from Santa Monica to Pomona. At 2:27, all Southern California radio stations were ordered off the air, except those in San Diego. Approximately 20 minutes after the firing died down, the ship returned and headed westward from Long Beach toward Santa Monica. The guns went into action again, hurling round after round of shells at the object. The second barrage appeared to be closer to downtown Los Angeles, since watchers could hear the concussion of the guns more clearly and the flash of bursting shells was brighter. Then the ship disappeared for the second time over the ocean. We return you now to CBS in New York.
Yeah, sorry about the 70-plus-year-old quality of that audio, guys. But, you know, it happens. But you do get an indication as to what happened. Fascinating. Not a single bomb was dropped on the city for all the shells that went up. You know, so it makes you think,
yeah.
What were they shooting at?
Something up there. I guess when they tell them to start shooting, as we said, you keep doing it. We talked about that in the Coventry episode. As far as the anti-aircraft of the day, it's hard to knock something down. So, man, you would just aim as much metal as you could into the sky if you thought something was up there and hope you hit something. Because it's impossible for us to wrap our brains around today. We're used to, you see a plane, even if we've all played video games, not that it's the same as war, but we're used to clicking something and having something happen. So that's not what this was.
Well, listen, I mean, our drone program, you know, whatever one thinks of it, you have a generation of kids growing up on video games to thank for the effectiveness of it. I mean, they put video game fans in those things, you know, it's crazy. But this, though, you know, this night, so all these shells go up, chaos rules. You know, people think or claim they saw, you know, bombers, they saw parachutes. You know, later on, we'll talk about UFOs, anti-aircraft shells raining down on cars and homes. If you got 10,000 air raid wardens trying to enforce a blackout, cars are crashed everywhere. People are driving in the dark with their lights off, sort of like what happens in L.A. now. And the Japanese-Americans who had just been told about the executive order, they encountered all sorts of hassle during the scare, accusations of signaling Imperial Japanese, blinking their house lights suspiciously. Quite a few were rounded up, jailed, and fined. I want to get Steve's take on this because he lays it out without hysteria and without sort of going down the UFO road. But here's Steve's take.
I tend to agree with the official records of the military, and I do that based on interviews with survivors. Survivors, there was nothing to survive, but you understand
sure. What
I'm getting at. But it basically archival evidence, personal interviews, people who were there, and it does seem to corroborate the idea that there were meteorological balloons that were launched that night in what was called a green status one. And what green status one means is anything in the sky becomes a target. And that green status was issued by the Army Air Corps or Army Air Forces. And the Coast Artillery and the Air Forces were just getting to know each other and how is this going to work? And basically what I think it was confusion. It was confusion in communications and confusion in understanding what a green status, number one, meant.
Why did that first trigger get pulled?
Great question. I love it. Let's start with 7 o'clock in the morning, or 7 o'clock in the evening on February 24th. The Navy issues an alert that says, expect an attack tonight. The Navy issues that. Now, you're a Coast Artilleryman, you're a gunner. You get your information and it comes through and says you're going to be attacked. So you're already keyed up. One of the key things in learning how to fire your guns is to have accurate measurements of wind speed at altitude. So the Met guys, what they call the Met guys, meteorological section, goes ahead and launches their balloon. But again, the Air Corps, Air Force officer, he's called an area controller, a region controller, issues a green status one, which says anything in the sky is to be shot down.
It's fair game.
So the guys launch the meteorological balloon, and it's in the sky, and it's identified, and the order comes through, shoot down the balloon. So it's not the guys pulling the trigger, it's the area controller, or the regional controller, says, shoot down the balloon. They respond. But it's our Met balloon. He responds, shoot it down.
And we're off to the
races. And there we go. Yeah.
Amazing. So that first trigger gets pulled, and what is it, 1,500 shells? What's the number that we're talking about here? What flew into the LA sky that night?
I don't think the exact number can be known. They say 1,400, and I think they say 1,450, but those numbers don't take into account, for example, the ammunition that was fired at Fort MacArthur. There's really no record of small arms ammunition, whether that was fired or not. So it's hard to say, but we could go with the typical number, which is around 1,400.
What part in the operation did Fort MacArthur actually play during this event?
Fort MacArthur had a limited role. We fired approximately 15 rounds from our anti-aircraft battery, which at that time was manned by Battery F. They had been mortar troops before, working on 12-inch Seacoast mortars, and then they figured that the threat was going to be from the air, and so they moved those guys, they transferred them to anti-aircraft duty.
As the balloon continued its lazy drift up the coast, the shooting became frenzied. Sergeant John Ziesler with the 122nd Coast Artillery in Downey said that as soon as his battery went into action, everybody went crazy. Quote, guys were seen firing 45 pistols, rifles, submachine guns, even the 37mm guns from the roof of the aircraft plant were firing. You could hear the expended ordnance landing all around.
And you notice we said a balloon up the top of that? That's what we're kind of thinking. That's what we're believing it was. Sorry, UFO guys.
Well, the UFO, the letters right just mean unidentified flying objects.
That's exactly right.
So it could
right.
be anything you look up and see and
that's
don't
a
know
good,
what
that's
it
a
is.
Very good point. Secretary of War Henry Stimson issued a statement confirming 15 planes. And this was immediately and directly contradicted by Navy Secretary Frank Knox, who said, quote, there were no planes over Los Angeles last night, end quote. The whole thing was a false alarm. 8 people did die from this, 3 from heart attacks and the rest reportedly from blackout-related traffic accidents. So it was not without people paying the biggest cost.
Trampling people of the Brooklyn Bridge. We've talked about that before.
Well, that's right.
All it takes is one person to yell, oh my gosh, it's collapsing, or somebody to think they yell that. They could mishear them, and panic can kill. That's often
it
the
can.
Way in disasters.
I mean, geez, I remember 9/11, you know, I after the first tower collapsed and before the second one did, I ran downstairs to the store. So, you know, I had a sort of a light adrenaline buzz going and I ran down. I'm like, all right, I got to get batteries. I got to get cigarettes. I was smoking at the time. I got to pull out cash. I got to get water, this kind of thing. I just sort of went into this basic survival mode notion and I went into the bodega downstairs from me. And there was a guy in there and he was wild-eyed. He was like, the president's dead. They destroyed the White House. You know, he started talking about all this crazy stuff. And I said, listen, calmly. I said, we don't know that. I said, but you know what we do know? I said, we know what's going on right down here, 4 blocks away from us down the block. I said, and that's enough. You know, that's enough to have to deal with. And you could see like the fear kind of drained out of his face and drained out of his eyes. And he was like, thanks, man. Is this scary? I'm like, yeah, it's scary. But you know, it's one of those things. You can just drop a match right into that and you got panic.
Yeah, and people start reporting stuff and it's going to be
worse than ever now. We both worked in news at the time, and you knew that there were problems with misreporting. Now, God forbid, the next time something like that happens, it's going to be terrible. Look what happened yesterday. A plane skidded off the runway.
LaGuardia.
Yeah, I mean, it happened to MSNBC, but it happens to everybody. Somebody calls, and they stick the malacca on the air, and he's pretending to be. You can't do that. There's no. Not the vetting that there would have had to be back in the days of just radio wireless.
It sort of does draw this whole notion that we're talking about, though, which is, you know, even people make bad decisions to get something on air, and that's a producer's anxiety, perhaps, or a producer's, you know, sort of losing his fastball amid an upsetting situation. It's interesting, though, what Steve and the gang at Fort MacArthur did. As the day progresses and the music is playing and the MC and everyone's having fun, people are eating, you know, and there's wine and beer and such, and we're given a sense, slowly, that something is closing in on us. Listen.
Right now, ladies and gentlemen, I've been handed a bulletin. We'll be announcing bulletins as they arrive throughout the evening. I'd like to let you know the Army Western Defense Command has just announced that a Japanese refueling base has been discovered on one of the islands off Vancouver, Canada. Nothing to worry about at this point. Canada's a long ways away. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we return you to our program with Gene Moran and the Fort MacArthur Officers Orchestra.
I just love that. It's just like, you know, sorry, folks, just a little heads up, you know, Japanese refueling station off the coast of Canada, far away, but it's great. It begins to sort of foreshadow for us and deep seeds basically the stage drama that they're putting on over there.
It's just great how much they put into this. And again, I think next year people are going to want to go and see this, but there are things right there by you where they do this. It's really a great way to teach history.
It is. And you know, the longer I live out here in L.A., I realize, you know, how important this town was in the story of the Second World War. You know, in a way that certainly, I couldn't have been bothered even thinking about this place, much less, you know, coming to live here. But you do realize over time just how impactful that war was in here and how truly petrified people were. I want to start tossing to some reactions of just folks who were there throughout the day. Let's just listen to a few of these.
Yes, I was 5 years old, and we lived in Redondo Beach, and we had to have blackout up at our windows. My dad built tar paper frames for the inside of the windows, and then there was times when there was air raid sirens and blackout night. And one night I remember sitting on my mom's lap, and we lights out and peeking out the window and looking up at the sky and seeing the searchlights come on, and from somewhere which I didn't know they were there. Being five, I don't remember all the details. I only remember the one scene in my mind of looking up at the sky out the window and seeing the searchlights crossing, and they focused on an airplane. There was an airplane slowly going across like an airliner of those days, you know, way up high. And there was a couple of firings at them, but the shells burst below. They weren't reaching it, and a piece of shrapnel fell into the lot next door. And that has been forever embedded in my brain.
Here's an interesting guy named Kevin Summerfield. He had a very personal reason for being there. Give a listen.
My name's Kevin Summerfield. I'm a retired history teacher. And the reason why I'm here is my father served in the Army Air Forces in World War II. And as a matter of fact, he told me in 1942, he got married on the 7th of February. And he was ordered, he was a brand new second lieutenant, and he was ordered to lead a flight of three training planes. I think I call it PT-17s. And they had one wing underneath the plane, the fuselage, and two seats on it. And he was the lead pilot, and in the back seat of each plane were navigators. And they flew all the way down from Sacramento to San Diego, and they were coming back that night. And they were flying over Pasadena, and he said he took small arms fire as they were going by. All on this. So for me, this is a really important event. I mean, it's my dad's involved in this, you know. So that's why I'm a reenactor. I can't afford a B-24. I do have an old Dodge Army truck that it needs to be fixed. But I do the best I can as an infantryman. So, yeah.
Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Again, we talked about people reenacting just because they pick somebody that they get out of a book, mm-hmm. maybe, or what have you. We didn't talk about the idea of having a personal connection and coming out there. I mean, Fort MacArthur, if you're a MacArthur or if you have a name, it's always a thrill to look in that battle role and see, wow, that guy has the same name as me. And I'm sure that's especially the case if you're a Japanese American. You always lift those people up. As we said, they didn't have those American Japanese heroes right then who happened to be of Japanese descent. And that's a great thing to do. And in a small way, you're able to say, I have even more of a connection and I'm keeping them alive. So what a great feeling.
It is. It is. And here's a woman who's got a really sort of interesting point. I think that's something that hits the sweet spot of why this day at Fort MacArthur works so well. Give a listen.
What do you think when you see an event like this, this air raid scare, and even the world, even the war itself, remembered in such a way? Do you like being at this event for that?
I think it's a really wonderful way to pay tribute to all of those people who served and gave their lives and separated themselves from their families for many years. And I just think it's a wonderful event to make other people, younger people especially, aware of what they sacrificed and appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate you taking the time, and enjoy the rest of your day here. Thank you.
And there were a fair amount of young people there, which was nice. It was good to see. It's funny, Dean, you were talking about the three bells before. What we had at Fort MacArthur a couple weeks ago was the Satin Dolls, and they were great. Oh, my God, they were great. First of all, they were a bunch of appealing-looking dames. Appealing-looking dames, I tell you.
Nice pins, I bet.
Yes, nice pins on those dames. But they delivered. You know, they looked great. They sounded great. They knew all the songs. You know, it was just such a great piece of theater to add to this. And I just, you know, I spend so much time walking around, and I'm listening to music at one point, and I'm sort of looking around, and it's starting to dusk a little bit, and I see there's an older gentleman, great head of hair, by the way, standing by a
Thanks
Jeep.
Thanks a lot.
I went over to talk to him, and this was the beginning of our conversation. Have a listen.
What brings you to this event today, sir?
Oh, well, my sister-in-law lives in San Pedro, and she heard about this event, and I sort of wanted to see it because I'm 82, and so I'm of the age of when they had the invasion and the threat of invasion and things like that. So it's very interesting to see this place and see all the fortifications that they have here. So it's wonderful. It's great information for people to see.
It is indeed. What were your recollections of the time of the early 40s?
I'm of Japanese American descent, and I was put into Camp Manzanar during World War II, and so it's sort of to be here. It just reminds me of when I was in Camp Manzanar back in the 40s. So.
Now, where was Manzanar, sir?
Manzanar is in Inyo County, somewhere between Independence and what's up there? Don, I can't think of that lake up there where there's a lot of fishing.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Mammoth. It's right in that area.
Do you recall feeling as a young American having to follow that Roosevelt executive order? Can you tell me about that?
Okay. Now, I was 10 years old when I went to camp. So I didn't really feel it, but my parents did, I'm sure. And to have to go to camp from I was born in Hollywood, and we lived in Hollywood, and sure, it was very traumatic for my parents, I'm sure. And so we were very happy that we were able to leave after 3 years. So it was a experience that I'm sure none of us people that were in camp at that time to go through that. But we all did fine afterwards.
Born and raised in Hollywood, breathed his first as an American, and was rounded up and sent to a prison camp. I mean, it's kind of nuts.
Definitely nuts. That's exactly the word. Hey, war hysteria. What's the root word of hysteria, right? I mean, hysterical. Certainly not called war rational, though.
Although, rationing is something somewhat different.
Something else. I also wanted to mention that the idea of national citizenship as separate from your ethnicity, it's kind of in flux at this point. That's one of the legacies of the Great War. Of course, look at the massive Habsburg dynasty. You know, look at the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Look at the Ottoman Empire. A lot of these were built self-determination. That's what sparked the war, right? That's why that Serb decided he was going to shoot the Archduke, because he wanted self-determination for his ethnic people. Yeah, we are right. We had the Olympics. Okay. Yeah, but yeah, I don't think it was – it wasn't
Thank you,
as...
Dean, and your people, by the way, for that. Nicely done.
You're welcome. But it wasn't
and
as –
And for the pizza burger. Thank you for that, too. Sorry.
Well, we're never going to stop if you start thanking
things like that. I'll leave it at the Olympics and the pizza burger.
I just love one thing about history is you could be a person that knows nothing about history, never picked up a history book in your life, knows nothing. But if somebody thanks you for something related to your ethnicity that you had nothing to do with, you immediately – you swell with pride. And you say, exactly. Why, you're welcome, young man. I did invent the wheel, sort of.
Sort of-ish.
But – we talked about the fifth columns and we talked about the Great War and the legacy of Woodrow Wilson in World War One. And this is
that didn't take long.
This is not wedging him in here. It's really true. You go back and look and read, and he kind of gets this idea rolling. Not that Lincoln didn't do some in the Civil War. There's that one, I think his name is Vallandigham, that one congressman. Lincoln keeps sending him to the South from Ohio. I mean, a loyal northern state. And he keeps shipping him off. And then they don't want him. And they send him to Canada. And he sneaks back into the United States from Canada. And so that's not new. But Wilson kind of gets the ball rolling there in World War One with German nationals. If you were born in Germany, well, maybe we're going to start getting rid of you. Right. We're just going to put you over here for a while because we're having a war. And again, Black Tom explosion would have been very easy to do that, very easy to have this notion of collective guilt. And this was something that Franklin Roosevelt was able to build on with this very generalized order saying, yeah, whatever you think you've got to do, go ahead and do it.
Yep.
But provide food for the people and this kind of thing. What a guy.
Right.
But
so
this was sort of the idea.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, look at after 9/11. I mean, people were afraid it was going to start happening immediately then too. It's a scary thing, and it's a terrible genie to let out of the bottle. I want you to hear this. This 1943 film from the War Activities Committee of the motion picture industry nearly breaks its back trying to spin the internment of American citizens on the West Coast following the attack on Pearl Harbor. The fatherly voice you'll hear is that of Milton S. Eisenhower. He was director of the War Relocation Authority during its initial period of the operation.
When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, our West Coast became a potential combat zone. Living in that zone were more than 100,000 persons of Japanese ancestry, two-thirds of them American citizens, one-third aliens. We knew that some among them were potentially dangerous. Most were loyal. But no one knew what would happen among this concentrated population if Japanese forces should try to invade our shores. Military authorities therefore determined that all of them, citizens and aliens alike, would have to move. This picture tells how the mass migration was accomplished. Neither the Army nor the War Relocation Authority relished the idea of taking men, women, and children from their homes, their shops, and their farms. So the military and civilian agencies alike determined to do the job as a democracy should, with real consideration for the people involved.
You know, I listen to this and I keep thinking about the gentleman I met that night by the Jeep. This is a man that I was speaking with, that I could touch. We breathed the same air. And I'm looking at him thinking, this guy, this American was rounded up and sent away to a camp in America. This is another horror of war. And here's a bit more on how they tried to sell Executive Order 9066.
There were more Japanese in Los Angeles than in any other area. In nearby San Pedro, houses and hotels occupied almost exclusively by Japanese were within a stone's throw of a naval air base, shipyards, oil wells. Japanese fishermen had every opportunity to watch the movement of our ships. Japanese farmers were living close to vital aircraft plants. So, as a first step, all Japanese were required to move from critical areas such as these. But of course, this limited evacuation was a solution to only part of the problem. The larger problem, the uncertainty of what would happen among these people in case of a Japanese invasion, still remained. That is why the commanding general of the Western Defense Command determined that all Japanese within the coastal area should move inland. Immediately, the Army began mapping evacuation areas and for a time encouraged the Japanese to leave voluntarily. The trouble for the voluntary evacuees soon threatened in their new locations. So the program was quickly put on a planned and protected basis. Thereafter, the American citizen Japanese and Japanese aliens made their plans in accordance with Army orders. Notices were posted. All persons of Japanese descent were required to register. They gathered in their own churches and schools, and the Japanese themselves cheerfully handled the enormous paperwork involved in the migration.
And I would say, Milton Eisenhower, how would you feel if you came from a country that was currently at war with the United States and had declared war on us, and that was your ethnic background? Oh, wait, it was. That's a German name.
Yeah.
So it was it must have been really a strange feeling if that ever occurred to him. But it's, you want to say maybe it's a little nice that he knew enough at least to feel guilty and break their backs over it. At least they weren't full on for it. But really, that doesn't seem to have occurred to people, just because there was such a notion of, if you're Japanese, you're from Japan and you're on their side and we're not taking any chances. And the fact that people could not be bitter after all these years, granted, they did get an official apology from the President of the United States, President Ronald Reagan, and here he is at the ceremony, signing the bill, making restitution and apologizing on behalf of the United States government to the survivors of the Japanese internment.
The legislation that I am about to sign provides for a restitution payment to each of the 60,000 survivors, surviving Japanese Americans, of the 120,000 who were relocated or detained. Yet no payment can make up for those lost years. So what is most important in this bill has less to do with property than with honor. For here we admit a wrong. Here we reaffirm our commitment as a nation to equal justice under the law. Thank you all again, and God bless you all. I think this is a fine day.
It's so easy to carry bitterness around. We all do it.
Absolutely.
It's just amazing that you were able to breathe the same air as a man who was able to show you that side of humanity, of forgiving and understanding.
Yep, absolutely. And you know, what struck me at the end of that last soundbite from the propaganda film is, you know, how Eisenhower says, you know, the Japanese Americans cheerfully handled all the paperwork involved in the migration. Cheerfully. Anyway, I have a hard time obviously believing that. But here's what this gentleman had to say for the rest of our little conversation. Give a listen.
One of the things that was fascinating to me when I first moved to Los Angeles, I discovered, was that Griffith Park, which is right near my house, they held people there. They had a small internment camp there for a while, and right in the middle of the park where Travel Town is now, where a place for children to go.
I don't know. I didn't know about that one, because a lot of people were relocated to the Santa Anita racetrack, and they were put in the stalls for a while. You know, so it was right. It was something that they were in there for several months before they were finally relocated to a camp. So that was no fun for them.
May I ask, and I wonder, as an adult, certainly now, were there any feelings, what were your feelings that your country decided that treating natural-born citizens of this country in that way was what they had to do?
Like I said, I was 10 years old at the time, so it didn't really bother me.
In retrospect, though, yes, even now.
In retrospect, it was something. Well, I can see that there was a lot of panicky American citizens at the time of the war, because there was so much. There were some many subs off the coast, and I think one of the subs did actually fire a gun. So it scared everybody. I can imagine how it was that people were panicking. So I can forgive what happened myself, because I could understand that, because it could happen anywhere.
Thank you again, sir. All the best.
Okay.
Thank you.
He's got more grace than I would imagine I could muster, given the situation. I didn't live the man's life. I don't know fully what his soul is saying and feeling, but to his credit, he forgave. I said goodnight to him and moved along and continued the fun evening. And then, suddenly, right in the middle of all of our fun,
there it is.
clicked on. It was loud right there. It charged the whole place.
That was the big moment you were waiting for, and there it is.
Yeah, yeah. I was asking Steve how they pulled the whole thing off. Let's give a listen to what he has to say about his amazing production. You have so many moving parts. You've got, you know, catering, you've got dancers, you've got singers. I mean, I'd imagine a lot of this is volunteer-based, no?
Almost everything you saw was volunteer-based. Some of the things are hired out, but again, the way it flows and all that is largely done through the brilliance of Maxwell DeMille, who is our MC. He adopted this program, and he's the one that came to us and says, you know, you could take this to a whole new level. It doesn't have to be a bunch of museum geeks, you know, with their stuff. This could be a real experience. And he pushed us, and he pushed us hard. Things like dance floors. I'm like, well, why can't they just dance on concrete? No. You know, tables with tablecloths. You know, something, again, we could have cared less about. And gradually, we all of us sort of started appreciating each other and realizing that all of it makes for a great show. The searchlights, the equipment, people in uniform, the food. It's almost impossible. The place is not designed for catering, and yet we're able to pull it off. Although, I think if there were complaints, which I didn't hear, it would be because of the lines on the food. And it's just the nature of trying to use an old gun battery for a venue for a dance.
The reason I even met Steve was because I'd been, you know, as you know, I'd been searching for an air raid siren in the LA area that I could actually listen to. Because I've said before, you know, there's just so many that remain out here. You know, it's as I said in that video I shot of near the one near my house, Southern California is very kind to the elderly. Vintage cars and air raid sirens. These things will last a lot longer out here than they will a lot of other places. Anyway, a gent I spoke to online ended up giving me a line on Steve, and the rest is history. History, you see what I did?
And but, you can see that video of you, by the way, at our Facebook page, facebook.com/angryhistory.
Yes. But the whole thing began with my hunt for a siren to record, and here's Steve on the siren and some of the other very cool hardware from the day. Five, six, seven, and six. Now let's talk about some of the hardware I saw out there today. We were talking before this interview a couple weeks ago about that air raid siren. Break that down for me. Where'd you get that baby?
Well, the siren that you saw is a post-war siren, so this is what I was telling you about artistic license. World War II sirens are very, very hard to find. We do have one, but we had to build half of it. and it doesn't function the way a real siren would have sounded. So we went ahead and went with the Chrysler air raid siren from the post-war era, and it's powered by, you know, a Chrysler industrial engine, which is the grandfather of all Hemis that you see out there. Very, very most powerful air raid siren in the world. And that's the one we put way away from the event because we didn't want to blow everybody's ears out. The other one you heard was an electric one. I think it's a Federal electric one. Again, a Cold War era siren, but based on the technology of the sirens of World War II. And we found that when we fired those up, that it added a dimension to the event that people weren't expecting. Now, older folks remember the sirens every month, you know, that would just kind of get you ready.
Now, tell me about that, because this stopped before I moved here, but tell the folks, you know, what it was like growing up in SoCal and having these on, was it on a Friday?
It was Fridays, and I think it was Friday afternoons because I was very young when they stopped it. But, you know, you could remember it. It was just, you know, this loud, you know, beckoning sound, and you're going, you know, what is that? Of course, if you'd seen any World War II movies, you would know what it was. But still, for a young child, it was, I used to go to the fire station where the siren was located just to see it and to hear it up close. That was fun for us, but I think it's, again, something that the younger generation is not going to understand, and this gives them a little, I don't know, taste of what it's like. Oh my gosh, you know, we could get attacked type of thing.
And it is such a almost bestial sound that comes out of that. It's a chilling noise that screams, literally screams danger when you hear it.
Indeed.
Now, with some of the other hardware, I walked in and there was a tank just rolling around the ground there.
Yes, the tank, again, is a little bit of artistic license. That's a Sherman tank. We obviously did have them during World War II, but most of them were sent overseas. The tanks that we would have had at that time were the smaller, lighter tanks, and there were only six of them in Los Angeles, and I haven't pinned down their exact location yet. But it still gives people a very, especially when you start it up, that guttural, visceral clanking, and you can feel the ground vibrate as it comes by. And that, again, is more of that, what I was talking about earlier, that sensory experience. You know, it's one thing to have an intellectual experience or an academic experience with a book, but to see the smoke, to smell the smoke, to hear the sound, and to watch it go, it's just, and so we put it at the front gate, basically, because it goes, whoa, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore, right, type of thing.
Well, that's what struck me, too, walking in, is this multi-sensory thing is, you know, first, it's just the location. You're right on the ocean there, and it's to see the sort of, the way it's all laid out, and then you're seeing people in their costumes, and then you feel that rumble in your chest. I mean, I made a comment to Paul when that tank sort of rolled by. So you get that coming in, then you get the music coming in, drifting. So you really are given this sort of wonderful tapestry of elements. Even, and you say you're taking poetic license, right? Big deal. But you're getting this tapestry that pulls enough of these historical threads together to really make for an emotional experience. And I just, again, I can't say enough about it. What'd you have up in the air for that dogfight?
For the dogfight, it was a T-6, or an SMJ, as they call it in the Navy and Marine Corps. And that's flown by John Culver. And then we had Darren Moore's P-51D, known as Miss Kitty. Miss Candy, excuse me. Miss Candy. Sorry, Darren.
That's that transportive moment that we were talking about. You get to experience it.
I love this multi-sensory idea. You know, the whole event makes World War II a color event, you know, not the black and white one through which, you know, we're conditioned to lens it, you know, just based on all the archival that we've all seen.
It's so different. The black and white, especially, that's a thing. Visual. Like you said, a person, that's a living piece of history.
Yeah.
The tanks, the guns, the place you stand. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And the siren and the whole raid aspect, everybody united together. In a way, it's kind of a collective illusion, just like it was the night of the big attack. And it had this huge impact on the folks there. Give a listen.
Miss, how did that hit you?
It was actually really emotional. It's kind of scary and sad and terrifying and astounding.
Thank you for sharing that with me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
It's quite something to think that that's what was going on right here in this city that night almost 73 years ago.
Yeah. I'm really thankful that I've never actually had to think about that, ever.
Thank you. Have a great night. She was emotional. I mean, I was looking at her, and she was quite moved. Here's some reaction from another elderly gentleman who was there for the event. Give a listen.
What did you think about this reenactment of what happened 73 years ago?
Well, I was here,
I was watching these fireworks from all the anti-aircraft units around, I'm 82. So I was there at the time when this happened. And they were shooting at nothing, it turned out.
Yeah, they were shooting at nothing. That's how it goes. Hey, here's my reaction.
So the air raid portion just ended. It's kind of incredible standing there, watching the same sorts of lights in the sky that they used to try and track whatever it was that was up there. And to feel, although there were blanks, to feel all the ordnance thundering in my chest as it launched. The city thought it was under attack. The city thought that the Imperial Japanese were coming to kill them.
This is the Mutual Newsroom in New York, Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the news we've all been waiting for. Japan accepts surrender terms of the Allies. So for all of you who are so interested, for all of us from coast to coast, there are just 7 important words from Washington. Japan accepts surrender terms of the Allies.
Well, this is Owen Mugen at Fort MacArthur in San Pedro, California. This is a time machine. Let it stay broken. I'm loving it here. Back to you, two handsome fellows in the studio. Owen?
Thank you. Thank you, Owen. You've done a swell job. That guy is amazing. Sounds incredibly handsome.
Yeah, but it was 1942. And he's dead now.
That's right. You know what?
And dust.
I would have been 4F'd, man. I had flat feet when I was born. But I'm sure
they would have used you. You could have been an air raid woman. There you go. You could dress up next time as an air raid woman.
I might.
Tell everyone about your feet.
I don't know who I want to dress up as. There's some cool options. But I'll save it for next year. You were asking me, Dean, when I was prepping the show about the fort itself. So I put it to Steve when he and I got together this week. Here it is.
The fort was garrisoned primarily when it was finished, 1917 through 1923. And that ran all the way up through World War II. Then after World War II, they didn't really know what to do with it because the guns were not really relevant anymore. So then it became an air defense artillery base, and that ran from, let's say, the mid-50s up through 1975 when the Nike missile system was shut down.
Now, you guys actually had nukes on site.
They were on Fort MacArthur property, but not on the site that you were at. They would have been located up at the White Point launch site, known as LA-43.
Now, the name, of course, MacArthur. Which MacArthur are we talking about? Is it related to General MacArthur?
Yes. Now, many people think it's Douglas. It's not. It's his father, Arthur, who was a Civil War hero and also became the first Governor General of the Philippine Islands. And he had an influence with the development of the coastal fortifications, at least in our neck of the woods, because he had witnessed some of the things that happened with the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 and 05. And he just sort of suggested that, maybe we need to do some additional fortification.
Yep, Arthur MacArthur. Douglas is dead.
The only father and son team to win the Congressional Medal of Honor. The others, both awarded posthumously, are the two Theodore Roosevelts. Theodore Roosevelt, of course, the president and the Rough Rider, should have gotten it for Cuba, but was denied it and was awarded it by President Clinton posthumously through the efforts of Tweed Roosevelt and so many others. And then Theodore Roosevelt, for his actions on D-Day, as we mentioned in our D-Day episode, also denied it for political reasons, him being a Republican and his cousin, Franklin Roosevelt, being a Democrat and fearful that this general war hero was going to come marching back. He'd already blocked him from becoming governor of New York, FDR did, TR, because he feared his political rise. So he also gets a Congressional Medal of Honor after he's dead.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the only two father-son teams, and it's very nice to remind people just which one it's named after.
Absolutely.
L.A. is such a sprawl. You told me Steve's thoughts about protecting this sort of vast metropolitan angle. Let's hear that.
What is the philosophy, or what is a philosophy behind trying to protect a city as expansive as Los Angeles? I would imagine, I saw what Fort MacArthur had and the guns, and I know you guys had, there was defense lined up and down between Malibu and Palos Verdes. But what about inland? Was Griffith Park? Were there guns up there? I mean, how did the city, which is so expansive and sprawling, how do you deal with that?
Well, what's typical with the United States is we don't defend until we feel we actually have to. So we underfund the military for most of its life, and then some great tragedy happens, and then we get actives. So, for example, in World War II, we had 1,800 men, basically, to defend Los Angeles. Now, that was rapidly increased to, at least 30,000 in the harbor defenses, and then another 10,000 for the air defenses. Now, Griffith Park, actually was a National Guard base for a while. There was a runway over there, and there were some Guard troops stationed there. But during World War II, it became a base for members of the 37th Coast Artillery Anti-Aircraft Brigade. And those guys were stationed all throughout Los Angeles, and it augmented the coastal defenses that you're referring to.
Fascinating notion. I mean, you've been out here, you're out here years ago, and you see it's unlike any other city. Certainly, it's unlike our city. And just imagine the challenges. But it's very, very cool.
It's like that Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner clip that I sent you a while back. He talked about Newark, which is another big sprawling city here in New Jersey, and obviously with a negative reputation.
Sure.
And Carl Reiner said to him, "This city," meaning L.A., and Mel Brooks said, "What city? This is four Newarks pushed together."
That's a great line.
Every now and then I'll refer to L.A. as four Newarks, and Owen gets a kick out of it. But it gives you an idea of the scope. That's a big city. And
to huge. Think of,
it's completely different. It's why one of the reasons it's so different from New York, right? Because we have little boroughs, we have rivers, we have islands, and it's different from a place like L.A. where they can just keep sprawling and adding as long as, I guess, the water holds out.
Well, what the problem also is that, you know, you begin and you see this each year when it's wildfire season. And one of the thoughts is, you know, you have people living where nature really doesn't want you to live, you know, because part of the natural action of wildfires. But, yeah, pretty much soon we'll have massive skyscrapers everywhere. It'll look like Blade Runner in about 10 years.
Yeah, and it had to be related to the war, I'm sure, in some way. You're not thinking about building codes and where to put things when you're throwing everything up to try to win a war and produce all this massive wares you're going to need to fight it.
Well, and then after, yeah, the people who settled here after, I mean, they had a camp set up in Griffith Park, crying out loud, that people lived in because there just wasn't, you know, they also had a very small, I actually heard that in the SOT with the Japanese-American gentleman. They had a small internment camp in there too. But for GIs who were coming back and had no place to live yet, people set up camp. It's fascinating.
Wow.
Fascinating thing.
No look at history would be complete without a conspiracy angle.
Ah, yes.
In a nutshell, what happened that night over L.A. had nothing to do with the Imperial Japanese or weather balloons. Owen, you and Steve went over this, right?
Yeah, we did. Give a listen to Steve's take. The space alien angle. Why does this exist?
You know, I don't know why it exists. And part of me is I don't really want it not to exist. Because, believe it or not, there's quite a few people that come to the event. And, of course, we want everybody to enjoy it. And I don't discourage people from furthering their studies, if that's what they think. But for me personally, I think it detracts from the story of the men. And I mean, really, that's what we're about, is to preserve the heritage of the men that served here in Los Angeles and what they went through. And I think to sort of, I don't know if you've noticed, if you've read the blogs or you've read some of the discussions, mm-hmm. they've really reduced the night to, you know, an alien spaceship, and they base that on one photograph.
The one over Hawthorne, right?
Exactly. And they keep analyzing it, and they keep looking at it. And you know, what I find is, they don't even know the men. They can't even tell you who these units were. They can't tell you where they came from. They've not interviewed them. They've interviewed people after the event, right? It's usually after. So the eyewitnesses that I've read that they've accounted, almost all of them were civilians, so they didn't know the type of military equipment. Right. They didn't know what was being used. And when they do find, you know, a nomenclature of the equipment or something, it's thrown in there sort of to throw you off, like, wow, this guy really did his work, but there's really no depth to it. It's not, in other words, they don't understand what, you know, a provisional searchlight brigade was doing in the midst of a Coast Artillery AA brigade, or they don't know the relationship between the Army Air Forces and the Coast Artillery. They can't even tell you when they were formed and when they joined together as a combined air defense thing. And I think that's my biggest beef, is that they focus more on this, you know, study of one photograph, and then these opinions from people looking at the photograph, and then they go and they get some eyewitnesses, you know, who really I don't think would stand up credibly.
Right.
And so for me, again, I don't want to rain on their parade, and I certainly don't want to stop them from further investigation, but I think to really get the story right, we've got to know the story of these men, and that's something I'm working on right now. I'm trying to compile a very comprehensive history of the event, and it's going to focus on the men that served there. But I'm about halfway through it, so I can't really divulge some of the things that I've discovered. But let's just say they're in marked contrast with some of the observations by people who weren't there and people who use eyewitnesses that weren't military.
Right, and it's a great point to you. You take this one artifact of the event, which is that photo, and I'll post it, folks, and I'm sure you've seen it if you just Google Battle of Los Angeles, and then there it is, and it's sort of a dramatic-looking photo. But again, you can't base any sort of real academic study on one photo. But the odd thing to me is it's almost easier, it seems, for some people to think that it would be an alien invasion. And it's psychologically more comforting to think that than to think that the Imperial Japanese are out there wanting to kill us. I don't even understand that.
I mean, that might be, you know, the exact reason for it. I can't pin a thing on it. But what I can say is that there are so many mistakes in identifying the units and their locations and what the weapon systems were capable of. It's almost as if they make this assumption. And perhaps it's because of our society today. You know, our cell phones, we can do anything on those, research-wise,
right.
Okay? And I think that that technology being so handy at our fingertips sort of erases all of the hard work that made that technology possible. Because they assume, you know, that today in an F-18, it uses its radar to track some target, you know, I don't know, 150 miles away or something like that. So they just assume that radar has always been that way.
Right.
Or it's kind of like when we were kids, you know, we used to go to the grocery store with vacuum tubes
right.
for our television sets and test them.
Yeah.
A modern person is going to have no connection with that at all. And so I think it's just assumed that all of this technology existed at all times, and it just was there, rather than not realizing that those early radar sets, half the guys that had them, first of all, they weren't called radar. They were called radio detectors.
Right.
They didn't know how to use this stuff. At least in one case, Battery B of the 205th, they had one. It was issued to them, but it wasn't running that night because nobody knew how to turn it on. So it's a detraction from the real story. What I believe is the real story. And I think these guys deserve our credit. And I think they deserve to be known properly. And that's kind of what I'm working on. That's what the museum stands for and works about. And what's so fun is the event is sort of making it happen. I don't know. It's been a real boost to me to be able to be part of it.
Like, it never felt like a UFO thing to me at all. And, you know, I love UFO things. It's just what I was kind of thinking about this, and maybe there's nothing to it, and maybe I'm just putting too much of a reliance on the impact and reach of media, but this notion that the whole UFO Battle LA angle is tied up in leftover impressions from Welles' War of the Worlds from 38, at least from 2015 perspective, the events kind of were so close together. You know, they're 4 years apart, and both instances played on war fears, and they played on invasion fears, and that you can maybe see, you know, latent origins of the theory that this was some, you know, UFO over L.A. that night.
Yeah, Welles' whole, I'm shocked this happened. I just love that whole attitude that he has and that he comes clean on it decades later when it's sort of safe.
Yep.
But that apology after the broadcast is theater in itself.
The date of the broadcast was clearly stated as being 1939. Came, of course, as a great shock to us that the old H.G. Wells fantasy, the classic original for so many adventure stories, romances, and even comic strips, should have so profound an effect upon radio listeners. The invasion by mythical monsters from the planet Mars seemed to us to be clearly in the realm of the fairy tale. Deeply regretful that this is not so.
Deeply regret that this is not so. He's like, F you guys, F all of you guys.
That was what made him one of the greats, right? In 1975, Welles told the awesome Tom Snyder, quote, "There are pictures of me made about 3 hours after the broadcast looking as much as I could like an early Christian saint. As if I didn't know what I was doing. But I'm afraid it was about as hypocritical as anybody could possibly get."
Ah, it was great. I mean, it was such a wonderful thing. But again, whether or not it has anything to do in people's minds with the UFO angle, I don't know. But
Well, it illustrates what can happen, certainly.
Yeah.
One of the galling things when you look at it through Steve's prism is how this UFO angle truly cheapens what happened that night. You can filthy your shoes wading through this crap, but you'll find sites writing things like this, quote, "At least six people died as a direct result of the Army's attack on the UFO, which slowly and leisurely made its way down to and then over Long Beach before finally moving on and disappearing."
Like a...
weather balloon?
False flag! False flag.
Sorry. It's a totally false flag. Either that or it could have been Bigfoot. He was testing for his pilot's license that he was trying to get because he wanted to enlist too. Bigfoot's American. Come on. Or Bigfoot's... maybe Canadian, but still, we were both allies in the war. It might have been Bigfoot because he couldn't fly during the day. People would see a hairy guy up there. It wouldn't have worked.
No. And the difference is that Bigfoot is real.
And that site that you cited there about how you could dirty your shoes with this. I just thought you got to love how they will write things in such a way to give credibility to their sources. And I often think if these people put all this effort into writing fiction or just being a novelist, something, there would be such a better use of your talents. Like the computer people, they make these viruses. Why don't you dedicate yourself to making something good instead of making something bad? But anyway,
That's so fun.
They cite the woman's credentials, quote unquote. I'm making air quotes here.
Right.
As I'm don't like doing, but it's really necessary right here. They describe her as, quote, "young, beautiful, and highly successful interior decorator." Gee, well, okay. That sounds fantastic. Now I'm going to listen. She must have been telling the truth, and everybody else was lying.
That's to Steve's point, is that the witnesses that you have here are not even sort of necessarily trained to deal with details in such a way. You know, it's like, you know, you get overwhelmed by it. You know, he's like, he'd rather take the military perspective. It's important to note here, too, that post-war, the Japanese had no record we know of such an attack. But the event itself, you know, for all the upset, actually ended up being quite valuable. Here's Steve and I again. Part of this, to me, I think that one of the human aspects of this, which I find so appealing when I think about it, is this notion that this city was on edge. The city was afraid. I mean, you had had Pearl Harbor 2 months previous. You had the Wolf Pack's Operation Drumbeat, you know, in the Atlantic. People felt as though America was being squeezed from both sides. You had the Goleta oil field was shelled the day before.
Right.
And on top of that, you had Executive Order 9066, I guess it was even a couple of days before that. I mean, how did the city get itself on its war footing?
Well, I think actually the Battle of Los Angeles actually wakes it up and says, you know, get on the war footing. Everybody after, the thing people focus on is what a big mistake it was. Well, but look at what it did. It actually woke everybody up. It got us onto the idea, hey, we really are in a war here. And you got to keep in mind, you have Douglas, Santa Monica, Douglas, Long Beach, Douglas, El Segundo, right? You've got Northrop and Hawthorne, you've got North American and El Segundo, you got Lockheed and Burbank, you got Vultee and Downey. Our nation wins that war largely through air power, and the main manufacturers are right here in Los Angeles. And if we're vulnerable, and it seemed as though we were, you're going to take steps to protect that.
And here's an interesting bit from that chat Steve and I had about why we still care about a war that ended 70 years ago. I doubt you're ever going to see, you know, a Flight 93 reenactment. You're never going to see Fallujah reenactment. But World War II, why do we hold on to this? I mean, is it me? It seems as though we are holding on to aspects of time and the place and the manner at which we went to war in a way that still seems to resonate with us. Is it something we want still? I don't know.
That's another great question. You'll see it with Civil War reenactments. You can see the passion still there. World War II, I think the magnitude of it, because it encompassed everything. It encompassed you were even talking about margarine this morning, you know, which was something I hadn't even thought about. It touches every aspect of life, and it has been so documented and so filmed. I don't think it's going anywhere. And one could argue that it's shaped the 21st century. It may have shaped the 20th century, but it really is shaping the, for good or bad, we are still living with the legacies of World War II today.
That's really an excellent, excellent point.
Even though it's his job and it's his passion and it's something he loves, people don't always have to be that nice to you when you come out of the blue with a microphone and say, hey, I'd like to come wander around your event. Because it's, in a little way, it does break up the mood, maybe, if you don't have somebody who's respectful of it, that of course you are. It's like having a bad wedding photographer. You know, the guy's in the way all the time, and he's standing in front of people, and he's trying to make you reenact things. And
exactly.
So Exactly. Just great of him to take this leap of faith with us and to bring us all through that. I just wanted to get that
especially
out.
Especially talking about, no, it's true. And especially talking about the microphone. Like I was walking around there. It looks like I've got a freaking merkin on the end of my mic, you know, one of these wind socks. So it's like, I'm feeling slightly obscene as I'm putting this thing in people's faces while I'm walking around the fort. But here's some final thoughts from Steve and I.
You know, one of the things I'd like to get out to folks is, you know, not many people know we exist. We don't have an advertising budget. We are a very small museum with one full-time paid staff person. And we have tons of volunteers that are doing remarkable things. I mean, one-of-a-kind things that you can't see anywhere else. And so I'd really like people to come and visit us. And we're in San Pedro, so please come down and see us. Our website is www.ftmac.org, so fortmac.org, and check out our Facebook too, Fort MacArthur Museum Facebook, because that'll give you updates and you can see some of the skills with our restoration. We're actually using technology from the 40s to remanufacture or restore 1940s stuff, and it's really fun. And so if you can come down, again, we're short staffed, but if you really want to see something, talk to one of the staff people or anybody that you can find around there, volunteer, and say, hey, what are you guys doing? You know, I'd like to see it. And we'd be happy to show you what we're doing. We do have an event in the summer called Old Fort MacArthur Days. It's going to be in July, usually the weekend following 4th of July. I'm not sure we've ironed that out yet, but it'll be posted on our website. And that one is more of a historical time. It's not a time capsule. It's sort of a walk through history, if you will. Still very interesting to see and beautiful and cool in July. So please come and visit Old Fort MacArthur Days.
And of course, you know, we'll put all this up on our website for you guys to go check out and see if it's a great point. You're coming to Southern California. You're going to come for a visit with the family. You know, you maybe want to go to Anaheim and check out Disney, which is all great. Drive to San Pedro. I was just there for the first time last week. It's amazing. It's amazing. And you know, if you want your kids to sort of, you know, get history in their brains as they should, you know, bring them there to see these things, be able to touch and look. It's absolutely invaluable. And Steve, you do great work, and it's been a pleasure for me to get to know you through this process and to have you be involved. And I just thank you so much for your time and all your effort.
Anytime, Owen, and keep coming back and bring family, friends.
You got it. Steve Nelson, thanks so much.
Again, the website is www.ftmac.org. That's fortmac.org. And their Facebook page is Fort MacArthur Museum. Take a minute, look it up, and check it out. One of your favorite Artie Shaw tunes playing us out today, Frenesi.
Yep, which is Spanish for frenzy. I thought it was fitting for this one. And Artie Shaw actually formed a band much like Glenn Miller did, but he toured the Pacific while Miller covered Europe. Well, listen, this was a lot of fun. This is one like, I had been itching to get out for a while, and I'm glad we were finally able to do it. And again, thanks to Paul McNamara for coming and helping out, and Steve Nelson for his great hospitality and his passion, and for all the really awesome people I met that day. I cannot wait for next year to come back fully dressed, bring the whole fam-damly.
Yep, dress everybody up, get going.
Yep. All right, well, listen, this is it for now. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And we'll see you next time on The Angry History Show. Thanks a lot. Thank you.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Nice pins on those dames.